originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network. An intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who took Derby 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pradnik come again to beat He's Had Enough.
Raji Baraj aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano. A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now, here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I'm your host, retired jockey Christina McManigal, and I'm joining you tonight from our Jimmy John's of Lexington, Kentucky studio. I'd like to thank everyone listening tonight on Sirius 219, XM 201, and also to those of you tuning into our website at horseracingradio.net. So a portion of the proceeds from this show go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. The PDJF provides financial assistance to riders who have suffered devastating on-track injuries. If you are able to help, please visit their website at www.pdjf.org. So we're doing something a little different this evening, something that has never been done on this show before. We get to visit with a harness driver, and not just any driver, but one of the best of all time. He just won his 10,000th career victory, and he's only the second driver in history to win the Hambletonian and the Hambletonian Oaks in the same afternoon. He did that in 2011 with Broad Bond and Bold and Fresh. He's won numerous awards and ranks 7th on the all-time money earned list with over $171 million in earnings. It's a pleasure to introduce George Brennan. George, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Christina. I'm looking forward to it.
Pleasure to have you here, George, and I can't wait to hear your story. I will be honest, I know relatively little about harness racing, but I very much appreciate the sport and can't wait to hear your point of view and how you grew up and got involved in the sport. And you are actually from New Jersey, is that right? You grew up there, I guess?
I'm actually from Monticello, New York.
New York?
Yes. I reside in Jersey now, but I'm actually from Monticello, New York. I was born there. I graduated high school there. I started racing there. So that's where I'm originally from.
And did you grow up in a family involved in racing?
Yes, my stepfather, Joe Rico Jr., trained and drove horses at Monticello Raceway, and that's how I got involved at a young age.
I know, doing my research for this show, George, I read that you started out, you were still in high school, and you were driving horses.
Yeah, I started racing amateur races at Goshen, New York, when I was 14 years old, and when I drove my first horse at Monticello, I was still a junior in high school.
That's incredible.
That was back in 1984. Mm-hmm.
Such a young age. You knew what you wanted to do young.
Yes, I did. I definitely did know what I wanted to do at an early age. Well, before that, I did know what I wanted to do.
What were you like as a kid, George, growing up, going to school? Did you work in a barn from a young age as well?
Every weekend. That's all I wanted to do was be around the horses and be at the barn. And I was always there. I started right from the bottom, cleaning stalls, cleaning water buckets, grooming the horses, and eventually I got the jogging and training them. Yeah, so I was typical racetrack brat.
I love it. Did you have any brothers or sisters?
Yep, I have a brother, Jason, sister Kelly, and a sister Jessica. Yes.
Did they follow your path into racing?
My brother did a little bit, Jason Rico. He raced a little bit, but he's no longer racing now.
So, George, when you realized that this is what you want to do with your life, as you mentioned, from a very young age. What did your parents say?
Oh, they were for it. Oh, yeah, they had no problem with it. You know, and I think they had no problem with it because they kind of knew that's where I was going. You know, whatever they said, it didn't matter. You know, I was just going to do it. And, yeah, it was never an issue. It was never an issue what I was going to do or if I was going to go to college or, you know, work at the barns. No, it wasn't an issue at all.
They couldn't do anything about it anyway, right?
Mm-mm. Basically, they couldn't.
Now, did you play sports as a kid? Were you always pretty athletic?
You know, no, I wasn't really athletic, but I played baseball a little bit. I played soccer, but, you know, I just did it for – I wasn't really any good at it.
But you found something you were good at, and that was driving harness horses. Now, obviously, I'm a retired jockey, and growing up, in the back of my mind – as a kid, I was always aware of what I ate because I couldn't get too big to ride races as a jockey. But from a harness racing point of view, do you have to worry about your weight? Did you ever have to worry about your size?
Yeah, personally, I do. You know, I'm constantly watching my diet all the time, watching what I eat, and I know what weight I like to be at, and I try to be there all the time. I mean, I don't have to be as regimented with my diet as you did, but I do naturally watch what I eat all the time. And you know what? If I don't like what I weigh in the morning or something like that, I got no problem not eating for the day. You know, very little. You know, I'll have a little bit of fruit or something like that, and, you know, then I'll get back down to where I like to be again.
Sure.
Yeah, so it's not a lot. Definitely different than your game, but, you know, not a lot, you know. I know what I feel comfortable weighing.
This might be a stupid question, but do you have to weigh a certain amount to drive races?
Do we have to? No. No, we don't. No. But, I mean, if you look at all the top drivers, oh, I'd say most of us are, you know, within, I'd say 145 to 160. 165, 170, in that range there.
You find it's better to be shorter and just slight in stature?
Yes, I think so. Yeah, with no question. I mean, you don't see top drivers in harness racing weighing, you know, 2.25, 250. So definitely.
George Brennan joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, George, you're still in high school, and you're driving amateur races. And did you finish high school then?
Yes, I finished high school. Yep, I graduated in 1985, and I already had horses. So I was already training horses. I do them, you know, sometimes I do them a little bit before school, some definitely after school. And I was racing at that time.
And once
at that time, I had a provisional license, and there was a hold on. You know, they had a rule where provisional drivers couldn't drive on weekends, and there was only one provisional driver allowed in, say, a trifecta race, a triple race. So it really made it hard for me to race because I did have a couple horses, and they were weekend horses, and I couldn't drive them. So we did really well, but it really kind of stunk that I couldn't drive them.
So that provisional license, as you mentioned, was that just because you were new to the sport as a professional?
That's how it works.
Okay.
You work out, you have a, it works out where you have a qualifying license, then you got to meet to qualify horses, and then you got to meet that standard, and then the provisional license I had to hold for a year. And then once I met that requirement, the amount of starts I could get and the judges were able to determine that I was competent, then I was able to get my, it's called A license. And I got my A license when I was 17.
Definitely.
Maybe 18. I think at that time you had to be 18 to get your A license.
It's somewhat similar to what we have in flat racing, the apprenticeship. And, you know, that runs for a year from the day you win your fifth race. And so very, very similar. And I always wondered how that worked in harness racing. So at a young age, you already had your A license and you're a complete professional at that point. And George, let me ask you this now. Do you have an agent?
No, no agent. No, I freelance. We freelance, and it's up to us to pick the best horse. Like, I mean, if I'm listing out a couple horses in a race, there are certain trainers I show loyalty to who I drive more for as opposed to, say, like another guy. But for the most part, I try to pick the best horse. And you know, and as a jockey, well, you didn't lucky enough to have an agent. It doesn't always work that way, neither.
Right. But I would assume without an agent, that would be, you have to really hustle, obviously, in the mornings to go out and get those better mounts before you're actually well-known to everyone. So when you were starting out, is that what you would do? You would go around, walk the barns, introduce yourself?
No, we didn't. We don't really have to do that. But, I mean, if some trainer asked me, in a sense, we would because we qualify. So I would be a qualifier then. And but it's, you know, it's more so they'd want me. You know, I can't sell myself. I mean, you can, but it'd be like if you were training a horse, you'd say, hey, George, you want to come over and train this horse in the morning? Or will you qualify this horse for me, and I'm going to race him next week, and he's eligible to this class. That's pretty much how it works.
So for a typical young driver starting out, once you had that A license, how frequently were you driving in races?
Not as much as I wanted to, you know, because I was young. I wasn't proven at all. And, you know, then there's, you know, up at Monticello, you know, there were veteran drivers there who were very well accomplished. And they were getting the bulk of the work where, you know, I had to start at the bottom of the ladder and work my way up.
You mentioned the,
you know, there weren't a lot of opportunities for, you know, younger drivers back then.
You mentioned the older seasoned riders at Monticello. And I don't know how it is set up, but in flat racing, we have a jocks room. Now, what do you have? You have a room you all get ready in?
Yes, we do. Yep, we have a driver's room. And I'll go in tonight and go down, read. I'll look at tonight's program, go over that, and usually about 20 minutes before, I change into my suit, my colors, and I'm ready to go.
When you were starting out, being surrounded by these older riders, did you look up to anyone particular for advice?
Yeah, no question. Yeah. You know, I definitely looked up to my father, and, yeah, I looked up to a lot of those guys, and I still do, in fact. Yeah, I still look at I look up to some of the younger guys also as well. You know, you probably know as a jockey too. You never stop learning, and you know, you're never too good, I believe, to stop learning, and keep your mind open that way.
I love that. They say the day you stop learning in racing is the day you should quit, because
I believe that, no question. Yep.
Pretty impossible. George, you've mentioned your stepfather several times, Joe Rico Jr.
Yes.
Give us a brief detail of the success he had.
He was actually in 1978. He was a leading driver at Monticello, and he had good success up there. And then he went down to Yonkers in Roosevelt and raced there for a number of years. And he did okay, but then finally, you know, he got out, and now he's doing real estate, and he's very successful in real estate. But he's, with that being said, you know, he's still in harness racing, and he owns one horse right now, which is doing okay, which actually was supposed to race last night at Yonkers, but we canceled because of the extreme cold. So, yeah, he's still very much in it. I speak to him a few times a week, in fact, and we're very close.
What's the biggest piece of advice he gave you?
He always said, you just never get too high and never get too low. And And I've just kept that. You know, I never get too excited. I never, you know, when I have a bad night or things are going bad, you know, I don't really let it get to me. So he always said, never get too high, never get too low.
That can be tough, too.
It can be tough, but there's a lot of ups and downs in this game.
That is
for
sure.
In horse racing in general, yeah.
We know that well, George. And talking about when you first started out, you mentioned that was slow. And so talking about the lows just there, but you were starting out at Monticello. And how quickly did you find success? When did the wins really start piling up?
Probably around, you know, like 1987, 88, I started, you know, winning races and realized, you know, like I was okay at it. You know, I didn't think I was great at it by any means, but I said, you know, I can do this. I'm okay. And then, I think maybe like in 1989, I may have won, you know, the first year I won over 100 races. So, yeah. So, you know, it started piling up pretty quickly.
What was the first big race you won?
The first big race I won was in 1995 at the Meadowlands, which at that time was the mecca of harness racing. And it was a race for two-year-olds called the Woodrow Wilson. And I won that with a horse called a stud named Sue. And that was the first big race I won. And that carried on, I think it was like a $550,000 purse at the time, which was, wow, like unreal.
A stud named Sue. I love that name.
Yeah. Kind of interesting name.
What was that horse like to drive?
He was a nice little horse, yeah. Yep, I started, I don't think I baby raced him or qualified him as a two-year-old, but I started racing him in New Jersey Sire Stakes, and he was good right from the get-go. I mean, he won a couple of Sire Stakes. He won the Sire Stake final. Then he won the Woodrow Wilson elimination, won the final. And I think he may have won everything that year until the Breeders' Crown. I think he was second in the Breeders' Crown late in the year at Cardiff State Park. Yeah, he was a nice horse to drive.
Was he a front runner, or would he finish late?
Not at first. Not at first he wasn't, but in the Woodrow Wilson final, I eventually put him on the lead that night, and he won that way. He could do it either way. He was a nice horse. Unfortunately, he just didn't come back sound as a three-year-old. He won some good races as a three-year-old, but lateness issues.
George, you have a nickname, the Minister of Speed. How did you earn that nickname?
Well, thinking back, I think a friend of mine from Pittsburgh came up with it. I think he did. And I think I was racing a trotter that night from the nine hole or something. I showed no speed or anything like that. And I just sent him right out of the gate. And he wired the field and paid like $50. And he didn't show any speed or anything like that. So this guy came up with that name of the Minister of Speed. And I think he may have got in touch with the announcer at the time at the Meadowlands. And it kind of stuck from there. So we've had a lot of fun with it over the years. So it's been a lot of fun.
How do you do that, George? How do you get a horse that has previously shown no speed in his career to, you know, creep up there just right at the start?
Well, you score them down different. You score them down. You get them on the bit. You get them ready. You're trying to get them to leave. Like I don't know. It was so long ago that race. Maybe I looked it over and didn't see a lot of speed in the race, and his lines didn't look good. So I said, you know what? I got to try something different with him. So why don't I try getting him into the race? So I scored him down, got him on the bit, and left the gate, nobody else left, and I mean, he might have been on top by three or four lengths the entire time, and you know, he won pretty handily that night. So I don't know. And then sometimes you do it and it doesn't work. That, you know, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. You know, a lot of it's It's up to the horse.
Do you feel like speed is an advantage, and have you seen that change over the years, more speed, and people put more speed into their horses?
No question. No question at all in our game, for sure, where you have to be up close to the pace, because they're going so fast anymore. It's tough to make up ground into those fast quarters we race. You know, we race four quarters, and it's tough to make up ground when they're going so fast.
When you mentioned racing on a half-mile track and those tight turns, and I can only imagine how that would be even more difficult to make up ground.
It is. It really is. And then sometimes your hands are tied. If you draw the 6, 7, 8 hole and a couple guys leave underneath you, you know, there's not a lot of room for horses to leave on a half-mile track. So you got your hands tied, you take back, and you're getting away 7th or 8th. And very rarely are you circling a field from getting away 7th or 8th. So post position plays a major factor on a half-mile track.
I've noticed that in harness racing in general. It seems like post position is even more important in your game than in thoroughbred racing, because, again, those tight turns, I'm sure you're always praying to get down there on the rail.
Exactly. Yeah, you always want to get down to the rail. You know, you don't want to be outside, and you know, try to get a cover trip if you can. But then again, cover's only good if it's moving. You don't want dead cover. You don't want to have to go wide early. So a lot in our game, so much relies on the trip the horse gets. And a lot of times, if you don't get the good trip, it's not going to work out.
Another stupid question for you, George.
No, I doubt that.
Turning for home, you're dueling down the lane, and harness drivers have a different, obviously a different way in getting their horses to run. And I've had a lot of people ask me this question when I first announced to my friends I was doing this show. Everyone's like, well, why do the drivers almost yank back on the reins, like they're pulling on the horse's mouth while they're whipping the horse? I'm assuming that's to get the bit in the horse's mouth.
Yes, exactly. You still want to keep the bit in the horse's mouth and let the horse know that you still have confidence in them, where you're just not throwing the lines at the horse like that. And that's what I feel anyway. Like, I just feel if you just throw the lines at the horse feels, they don't feel the connection anymore. And they lose in confidence in the driver. So no question, I'm always trying to keep the bit in the horse's mouth to show him that I show him. Show the horse that I still have the confidence in that horse.
When you're driving a horse, that's especially your only connection to the horse is through the reins. So in harness racing, we have a term in thoroughbred racing, light hands. And you don't want to be heavy in the horse's mouth at the same time. So is that similar in harness racing? Do you want to have light hands but yet still remain in control of that bit?
Yeah, you definitely want to have light hands. Yeah, you don't want to. You want to have soft hands. Yeah, you don't want to be pulling the bit through their mouth either. You know, you do want to have soft hands. You don't want to have, as we say in our game, lead hands. You want your hands to be soft for sure. Yes, without a doubt. So that's the same connection.
George Brennan joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, George, you started out at Monticello, and in 1985 you earned your A license, and a couple years went by, and you're finding success pretty quickly. As you mentioned, in 1995 you won the Woodrow Wilson with a stud named Sue at the Meadowlands.
Yeah.
And what was your traveling schedule like? Did you remain based at Monticello, or did you move elsewhere?
I stayed at Monticello till like 1991. And then I went to Maine. I raced a couple years in Maine. Then I moved down to Massachusetts, track in Massachusetts in Foxborough, right next to the old Patriot Stadium. And then in the latter part of 1994 is when I moved down to New Jersey. And at that time, New Jersey was where it was at. Like, if you wanted to succeed in racing, you wanted to be at the Meadowlands. And at that time, when I came down, the Meadowlands wasn't, their meet wasn't open yet, so I was racing at Garden State Park and Freehold. And the Meadowlands opened, I think, like the day after Christmas of that year, and I started racing the Meadowlands then.
It's probably the only thing we have in common, George. I rode at the Meadowlands when they had thoroughbred racing there on the grass.
Yes.
And you mentioned before, it was at one point really the place you wanted to be, the highlight of all the tracks around. So why was that, and what was the competition like when you first arrived?
Well, it was that way because the money was so good. The Meadowlands offered the best purses in the game, and the competition was, it was the best. I mean, there were, you know, when I got there, you know, I wasn't amongst the leading drivers at first. However, but there were 15, there were 15 drivers that could be a leading driver anywhere in the country where they went, and they probably already were leading drivers at tracks they came from. So, I mean, it was, the competition was, it was tough.
And how quickly did you find success there?
That whole meet, that 95 meet, I didn't really get a lot of drives there until I started driving a stud named Sue, and I was going back and forth from Yonkers. I was racing three tracks. I was racing Freehold, Yonkers, and the Meadowlands. And then the Meadowlands shut down. I traveled the Grand Circuit route with stud named Sue some. And then I started racing Garden State Park in the fall full-time. And then when the Meadowlands opened in 96, then I started racing there full-time. And then I actually, you know, it started taking off at the Meadowlands where I may have been in the top five that first year in 96. So it took off relatively quick.
Well, George, we need to take a quick commercial break. Folks, stay with us. You're listening to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Hi, I'm John Velasquez.
And I'm Julian Lepau. Every jockey knows and accepts the risk of a sport every time they get a leg up on the horse.
Although catastrophic on-track accidents are rare, when they do happen, the lives of the jockeys and their family change forever.
It's up to all of us in racing to support these men and women.
That's why we support the Permanently Disabled Jockey Fund. Since its founding in 2006, the PDJF has disbursed over $8 million to over 75 permanently disabled jockeys.
Over 90 cents out of every dollar donated goes directly to these brave men and women.
They use their monthly stipend to pay bills, hire caretakers, and many other things that make living with a permanent disability just a bit easier.
This is Mike Penna of HRRN. Did you know that the PDJF has no permanent guaranteed funding mechanism and relies entirely on donations from people like you? Please visit the PDJF website at pdjf.org to learn how you can help.
Hi, I'm Ron Turcotte. I support the PDJF. I hope you will too. And I thank you.
You're listening to Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
Three quarters, 1:23 and 4:27.4 in that third quarter. It is Broadbond trying to go all the way. Broadbond, Whiskey Tax needs racing room. Man of Many Missions on the outside. Keep off stride. Man of Many Missions is off stride. It appeared it affected Whiskey Tax to the wire. That leaves it all to Broadbond, the Minister of Speed. And he's on Autobahn. Broadbond, Whiskey Tax, then opening night. And Chapter 7, 153, Broadbond wins the Hamiltonian.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I'm your host, Christina McManigal, and I am joined tonight by George Brennan. George, we just heard the replay of your Hamiltonian victory in 2011 with Broadbond in a wire-to-wire victory. And I watched the replay, and everyone could hear the replay. Thrilling finish, and I believe you were, what, 6-1?
Yes, he was 6-1, I believe, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Going into that race, what was your plan, and what was that stretch run like for you?
Excuse me. Well, my plan was to cut the mile. We won our elimination race, so I was allowed to pick my post. So I picked the number one, and with that picking the one, my intentions were going – were just to cut the mile. And that's why I went such a fast first quarter, because a couple of drivers, they left from the outside, and I left hard, like just to let them know, like, I was going to cut this mile. So I may have been on top by two or three going to the quarter pole, and then I was able to rate my second quarter. And then you asked about the stretch run. I mean, at the three-quarter pole, it was like, I just said to myself, I said, you know, it's over, you know, for that. I said, I mean, we didn't get home that fast, only like 29-2, I think, but I just knew that was a great 29 seconds, I can tell you, because I knew I knew I had just won, Broadbond just won the Hamiltonian, and it was a great feeling.
Broadbond was trained by Noel Daly, and yeah. I watched an interview with him after the race. Obviously, he was very, very excited. What's your connection to Noel Daly? Do you ride for him frequently?
I raced for him, quite a bit over the years. I drove for him. He's since moved. He went back home to Australia, and he's training standardbreds in Australia now. He just left maybe 2 months ago. So
really?
He's back home in Australia. So he's missed. He's a lot of fun to be around.
Yeah. Well, that same day, George, you also won the Hamiltonian Oaks with Bold and Fresh. And that horse was actually 24-1 at a late rally on the outside. That was even more of an exciting finish, if you ask me, watching the replay. That was just so thrilling to watch. And I'm going to ask you the same question. What was your plan with that horse, and how did that turn out?
I didn't have any plan going in. I'd never driven her before. And I got in behind the gate, and she's going on. She wanted to go through the gate. She was, you know, grabbing on. I knew if I took her off the gate, I'd be wrestling her, and she wasn't going to like that. So I left with her, got in, and I was able to sit up close. And if you saw the replay, I was slide out in the last turn and come wide, and she won. And she just did hang on. She wasn't the soundest horse in the world, and she was kind of hopping at the wire, like half running, but she got it done. She was awful game that day.
Yeah, you could tell watching. She had a big heart. She wanted that victory as much as you did.
Yeah, she did.
And, of course, you that day became only the second driver to win both of those races in the same day. Brian Sears, the only other driver to accomplish that feat. And do you know Brian pretty well?
Yeah, really well, in fact. Yeah, we're pretty good friends, yeah.
It's awesome to share that with
him. We played golf throughout the year quite a bit, and we're really good friends.
And so what is that atmosphere like in the room, surrounded obviously by your competitors, and you're friends with Brian? Are you friends with several of the other drivers?
It's real friendly. You know, we're in there clowning around all night, and it's like that in every one of the drivers' rooms I go to. We have a lot of fun, you know.
Yeah, you've been in several other rooms before the break. You were talking about your rigorous schedule when you first started out at the Meadowlands, riding at Freehold, Yonkers, and the Meadowlands. And I can't imagine how busy you must have been when you were going through that time. What was your schedule like?
It was, I'd race Freehold in the afternoon, and then the Meadowlands at night. So there'd be days, you know, I'd be racing 20 horses a day. And and then there were days we had to qualify also. So there'd be days I'd be qualifying in the morning at the Meadowlands, then run to Freehold, and then run back up the turnpike to the Meadowlands. So, yeah, it was a very tough schedule. But I didn't, you know, at that time I didn't know any better. That's just what we did. It was a way of life. And then when the Meadowlands would shut down in August, then I'd go on the road. You know, I'd be down in Lexington in September and race the Red Mile. And from the Red Mile, we'd go to the Little Brown Jug in Ohio, Delaware, Ohio. So, yeah, and quite a few trips up to Canada. So we were always on the road.
Canada.
Which I haven't done that in some time now. I've just been based at Yonkers, racing at Yonkers every night. Five days a week anyhow.
Was that a decision you made just to have a slower schedule?
Yes, indeed, yeah. And, you know, Yonkers has the slot machines up there, so now they offer the best purses in the country, so and they race 240 times a year, so there's a lot of opportunities there.
Well, you'll have to come back to Lexington sometime. George,
yeah,
to see us here for sure. I love the Red Mile. I've been there many, many times. And I read an article where there was a conversation between you and Brian talking about that change where everyone was riding at the Meadowlands and then the money went to Yonkers. And so a lot of people switched their tack over to Yonkers. And so is there still good money at the Meadowlands? Is there still good opportunity? Or has that basically just entirely moved to Yonkers?
There is, and the money is good, Christina, but the Meadowlands only races, I think they have like 81 or 82 days, and they only race 2 days a week. So, you know, I opted to race the 5 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even though it's a little farther from my house, I got to deal with the George Washington Bridge every night.
Yikes.
you know, but that's just what I elected to do.
Would you say there are bigger races at the Meadowlands, or is it pretty even?
Yes. You know, they still had the Hamiltonian, they still had the Hamiltonian Oaks, and but Yonkers has a good deal of good races also.
George Brennan joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. George, I want to talk about a few of your other big mounts. Glidemaster. Glidemaster was a pretty nice horse, and tell us how you got the mount and the success you had together.
I got that mount because John Campbell was driving him, and he was in an accident, and so naturally he couldn't drive him anymore. And the trainer of Glidemaster called me to race him in the Yonkers Trot, and he won the Yonkers Trot that night, yeah. And that was a great honor. The Yonkers Trot, there's a lot of history there. And at the time, he set a track record doing it that night. So it was a really special night that he did that. And then I think I raced him in the Breeders' Crown at Woodbine, and he was second that night. So, yeah, he was special horse at Trot.
Didn't that Yonkers Trot, didn't that wrap up the Triple Crown?
Yes, it did, yeah. The last leg of the Triple Crown.
I watched that replay as well. And early on, several horses broke stride. And so it basically turned into a four-horse field, in my opinion. But the stretch run was exhilarating. You dueled it out with Algeo's Hall on the inside, and you were on the outside. And, I mean, at any point in the race, I couldn't have called the winner. And so I can't imagine what you were thinking in that moment.
Well, especially because Algiers Hall got over the half so slow. Like, I think he got down there in like 59 seconds, which is really slow for that caliber of horses. So I knew I had to race him down the backside to, you know, take some steam out of him, where, in fact, you know, I was doing it to my horse also, but I did thought my horse could handle it. I thought I had the better horse, and which I did have the better horse because it proved down the lane because, you know, within the last 16th of a mile, he just trotted away from him. So he did go a good race that night.
Talking about the earlier in that race, several horses broke stride. How does that happen? How do you make sure that doesn't happen as a driver?
Again, it goes back to soft hands. You got to keep a firm grip on them, but not real tight. And then Christina, there's times nothing you can do. They'll just go off stride, and you're like, oh, boy. You know, there's times I come in and I'm trying to say, why did he make a break? Why did he go off stride? And like, I couldn't tell you, no reason at all.
George, when that happens, you are supposed to pull to the outside until you get back in stride, and then you can still participate in the race. But, I mean, do you ever really win when you break stride?
Not too often.
Yeah.
No, not too often. You're usually out of it after that.
A difficult task and something, you definitely don't want to happen.
No, you don't want that. You don't want that to happen, no.
George, talking about another horse, Artist's View. I heard that was one of your favorite races. He was 42-1 in the 2007 Breeders' Crown at the Meadowlands and won that race wire-to-wire fashion. And tell us why that horse is special to you.
Well, no, he didn't go wire-to-wire fashion because he had the 10-hole at the Meadowlands.
Oh.
So I got away back, and there was a wicked speed duel up top. Like, they went to the half in like 53 seconds, and it was chilly out that night. And he came from out of the clouds and won. And it was a special win for me because my friend Buzzy Schulte, who's actually from Lexington, Kentucky, he trained him and owned a piece of him. So it was a real special win for me and Buzzy, in fact. It was a lot of fun.
You said it was chilly that evening, and if you're currently driving at Yonkers at night right now, I can't imagine how cold you must be at night. But how do you deal with that? How do you stay warm?
Well, we dress for it. We have different suits and put toe warmers in, and I don't wear hand warmers, but in between races I use, I'm gripping my hand warmers in between races and then just go out and you just got to tough it out. It is what it is.
The horses don't mind it. They love the cold, but the drivers, that's a different story.
Yeah.
George, another horse, loved watching the replay on this horse. He had a huge stride and actually set the world record. Holborn Hanover in the 2006 U.S. Pacing Championship at Meadowlands. I don't think I've ever seen a horse with a bigger stride. And took the lead early on the backside, actually made a bit of an early move, and then just the race was pretty much over from there.
Yeah, he did. He was flawless skated. He did have a very, very big stride to him. And you're right, I did. I moved him to the lead at the half in 53-3, which is a good half. And I think he got down three quarters in 120-4, which is fast. And he set the world record that day and came home in 26 seconds flat, which is unheard of. And I think that was in 2006, and that world record held up for maybe till like a year or two ago.
Wow.
So, and that was with the old race bikes we had. So it was quite a feat for what he did at that time. You know, now horses are doing it quite regularity. They're going that time, but he was able to do it, and it was, you know, it was an amazing mile at that time.
I heard he was 5 years old at the time.
Yes, he was. Yep.
Which I would assume that's an extraordinary feat for an older horse, especially.
Yeah, it was. And he came back and he had a good 3-year-old campaign and didn't come back good as a 4-year-old. And then as a 5-year-old, you know, he came back like that really good, you know, and I don't think he ever put in a bad race.
Nice to drive those kind, isn't it?
Yes, it is. They're push button.
Exactly. And then you mentioned you would ship up to Canada and drive up there. And did you ever go anywhere else internationally? Noel Daly, of course, trains now in Australia. I know Australia loves harness racing down there. Have you ever traveled elsewhere?
No. I went to Ireland a couple of years ago, and I raced over there. But that would be it. Yeah, that was it. I've never been to New Zealand or Australia or Italy or Sweden or anything like that. No, I haven't.
How is it different in Ireland?
It was a lot slower. Like the horses there, they're not bred like our horses. It was a half-mile track. It was interesting, but it was just like a little fair track I raced on. So it was certainly different. But the people there were great. It was a lot of fun.
Of the tracks you've been at here in the States, which do you consider your favorite?
When I was racing at the Meadowlands full time, the Meadowlands, no question, was my favorite track.
What was it about that track?
The whole facility, like you said, you raced at the Meadowlands, like the whole facility, the driver's room. I mean, it was just a beautiful place. And now they have a new grandstand on the other side of the track where they don't use the grandstand or the driver's room that we had at the Meadowlands. So it's a lot different now. And they updated the grandstand a lot smaller, of course, which is a very nice grandstand. But back in the day, the Meadowlands was definitely my favorite track.
George, earlier in the show, you said your stepfather told you not to get too high or too low. So we've talked about the highs. Now we're going to take a second and talk about the lows. You've had a few injuries. Actually, the first time I talked to you, a couple of days later, you went down in a spill. But fortunately, you weren't injured. I was concerned, obviously, watching that. And for me, watching a spill in harness racing, it looks especially traumatic because you're not just dealing with the horse and the rider, but you're also dealing with the bike and all of that equipment going on. So I'm assuming what typically happens is what we call in horse thoroughbred racing, clipping heels, but you'll actually clip tires, I guess.
Yeah, we locked wheels. Yeah, me and another driver locked wheels, and I just got tipped out, and it happens. I mean, and then sometimes, I mean, I was in a race the other night, and a guy in front of me, I was following, but I was going wide around him, but he got interfered with, and he came out, and I hooked wheels with him, but we were able to get unhooked quick enough. So, you know, a lot of times you get unhooked, but that night at the Meadowlands, I wasn't able to get unhooked, and I got flipped out. Yeah, so it happens.
I know. I watched a spill that you were involved with at Poconos in 2008, and that was especially ugly looking. And so, have you broken very many bones?
Yeah. Like I've broken bones in my back, and that one at Pocono, I had a compound fracture on my wrist, which laid me up for 4.5 months. So. And the funny thing is, the horse, well, it's not funny at all, but the horse I was following that day actually grabbed a shoe. His hind leg grabbed his front shoe, and he tumbled. And when he tumbled, I was right behind him, and I got drilled from behind and landed on my wrist and pretty much shattered my wrist. Mm. So that was my worst injury to date. I broke a collarbone at Freehold 1 year. So that laid me up for about 6 weeks, but for the most part, I've been lucky.
What's the average career span for a driver? How long do people usually drive in for?
They drive into their early 60s. Like John Campbell retired at 62, who's our all-time leading driver in the game. Mike LeChance, he might be second or third all-time And I think he drove till like he was 62. Ron Pierce drove till he was 60. He's not driving anymore. So you can drive. David Miller, David Miller might be our second leading driver in the game now. And he's like 54 now, and he's still doing well, very well, in fact. So, I mean, you could drive well into your 50s. But, you know, with that being said, you got to keep your body in good shape and show up to work.
How old are you, George?
I'm 51. I'll be 52 in April.
And do you ever think about many, many, many years from now when you do retire, do you think about what you might plan on doing?
No, I don't yet. No, I don't.
Far away from now, you won't have to worry about that for a while.
Not you know how time flies, though, so it's not that far away.
George, real quick, I want to go over all of the, can't mention all of them, it might take up the rest of the hour we have left, but you were honored by the United States Harness Riders Association, the 96 Rising Star Award, 2010 and 2011 Driver of the Year Award, and that's just to name a few. Harness Tracks of America's Driver of the Year. That's one of the most difficult awards in the sport of harness racing to win. You won those awards in 2012 and 2013. One of the most respected drivers in the sport. And if I were a young driver coming up to you, what's the one piece of advice you would give to me?
Work hard. You got to work hard and you got to show up. And like my father always told me, don't get too high and don't get too low. But the whole thing is, you got to work hard and show up. You got to do your job.
George, if you could go back in time at any point in your career, would you change anything?
No, I don't think so. No. I'm very, very satisfied with everything that's happened in my career, and no, I wouldn't change anything, no.
Well, we only have a few minutes left here on the show. The hour has flown by. George, I heard you have a daughter.
I do have a daughter, yes, yeah.
And is she interested at all in following your footsteps?
No, not at all. She's in nursing school now in Mississippi. And she went 4 years to Mississippi State, and now she's in a nursing program in Columbus, Mississippi, which is like 20 minutes south of Starkville, Mississippi, where she went to school. So, no, she's not interested.
Well, it sounds like she still has a bright future in front of her.
Yes.
What do you do for fun in your free time, if you have any free time?
Oh no, I have free time, but this time of year is kind of tough to play golf. But I play a lot of golf when I can.
Are you very good?
No, but you know, no, I don't really get any better. But I have fun. I'm not terrible. I know how to play the game. I play fast, so I don't hold anybody up, and I'm competitive with the guys I play with.
Love it. George, you've already accomplished so much. I think everyone knows that after listening to this time we spent together. But any other goals you still hope to accomplish in your career?
I've never won the Little Brown Jug. If I could ever win the Little Brown Jug, that would be great. I've been second in it three times, a couple thirds in it, and I've never gotten that win. So the Little Brown Jug would be awesome. It's a great week down there. It's fun. And I'd like to win that.
What have you seen change in the sport of harness racing other than the speed we mentioned earlier? What else have you seen change throughout the years?
The equipment's gotten better, which is made for, you know, the speed, make them faster. There's a lot more drivers today. There's a lot more younger drivers. The younger drivers have a lot more opportunities today than, like, guys like my age when we started out. But, You know, it's still horse racing. You know, you got to go around, got to try to get first, try to win every race. So not much has changed in that respect. Still a horse race, and the ultimate goal is to win the race.
Any changes you would like to see happen in the sport?
No, not off the top of my head. No, not right now. No, it's going pretty good. The sport really is. It's in it's a good frame of mind right now.
Love it, George. Now, what's your schedule this winter? You're riding at Yonkers, and how many days a week do you ride?
Five. Like I'll go out a little later. I'll run a couple errands. I'll come back. I'll take a nap, and I leave around 4:15 to go to Yonkers, and then usually get done. We get done around 11. Clean up and drive home. That's pretty much my routine.
George, I want to give a quick shout-out to a dear friend of mine, Deborah Boyle. She's your biggest fan. She bets on you every single race, and she's the one who gave me the idea to have you here on the show today.
Great. Well, you tell Deborah I said hi, please.
I will definitely do that, George. It's been such a pleasure having you here on the show and wishing you all the best. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you very much. I enjoyed this interview very much. Thank you.
Folks, you can check out this show and replays of all of our other shows on the website at horseracingradio.net. Now be sure to join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. For our producer, Lee Della Pina, I'm Christina McManigal, and thanks for listening.